rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Larson, Judge Eid, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, January 24th, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today that are set for oral argument, the first of which is A22-1035, State of Minnesota versus Demetrius Antonio Wynn. Both parties will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. The podium can be adjusted up and down. There's a button underneath, and the microphone also can be adjusted so we can hear you. This proceeding is being live-streamed. It is also being recorded, and the recording will be available to the parties within a day or two. And counsel, for appellant, please state your name for the record. The party you are representing, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Tyler Bliss. I'm appearing on behalf of Demetrius Antonio Wynn, the appellant. Mr. Wynn requests this court remand for an evidentiary hearing on his post-conviction petition in this matter. At the core of the request is a lack of the trial counsel presenting any meaningful alternative perpetrator evidence, despite both parties in the case discussing it at length in the trial record. And I believe there is no other way to appropriately pursue that without having an evidentiary hearing where you can have the testimony of the parties. This case is about a jury trial where the jury found a 14-year-old boy had killed a 68-year-old woman. This resulted in a 27-year sentence. Throughout the trial proceedings, defense counsel discussed and even offered a notice of alternative perpetrator evidence. However, it never was backed up by anything meaningful other than allegations that were made on the court record about the existence of Peeping Toms and other individuals who could have been alternative perpetrators. But what's of note is both defense and prosecution discussed this evidence and said that they both had recollections of that evidence. However, in the trial court record, there's none of that.
Well, but isn't the issue here, I mean, it seems like trial counsel certainly tried to chase down any number. Wasn't there at least like seven other potential alternative perpetrators?
Certainly.
Okay, and isn't what happened here that as trial counsel tried to chase down each one of these, they just reached a dead end? Police said that they reached a dead end on a number of these. Prosecutor didn't have any information in their records, which would support a claim, which obviously they have to produce as well, and they're required to. And trial counsel tried to chase it down, and just each one ended up reaching a dead end?
I believe reaching a dead end is unclear at this point. I believe both trial counsels for the state and the defense, particularly in regards to the claim Peeping Tom, believe there to be police reports that haven't been produced, but both recalled hearing about.
Well, hearing about is one thing, but unless you have some type of documentation, how can you really move forward on any of those claims, and how can you fault trial counsel for not following up on, not doing anything more if there isn't any documentation, if there isn't any evidence to support that claim?
Well, I believe that this is the exact sort of situation that a post-conviction hearing through testimony could ferret that out. Again, this is, I believe, a very unusual conviction. You have a 14-year-old boy serving a 27-year sentence. And
why is that unusual? We've heard cases of juveniles who have committed crimes before. That's not unusual. Sadly.
While it is perhaps not unusual, the severity of the conviction here combined with trial counsel's reiterating that he had evidence but then not having it, I think what I take issue with...
Well, did trial counsel actually say he had evidence or that trial counsel wanted to pursue
yes.
further to try to find out and try to support an alternative perpetrator?
At least one point in the trial record, defense counsel indicated that he had a document that he just needed to, I believe he referred to it as his office staff, needed to pull those records. All of this was done sort of in haste in COVID procedures, and I don't think that those documents were ever fully ferreted.
Were they located at the time of the post-conviction proceeding? And
no.
So was there any allegation that the documents actually did exist?
That is what I don't think we have, and what I think an evidentiary hearing is necessary to determine.
But if we don't have an allegation that the documents actually existed, then why would we even construing the allegations in a light most favorable to your client conclude that the district court abused its discretion in summarily denying the post-conviction evidentiary hearing?
I guess I want to clarify if you're saying exist or existed. I think that there is an allegation that they existed. I can't make an allegation that they exist. I believe that both trial counsel discussed them as though they had personally seen them. And I don't think that without having an evidentiary hearing with those lawyers, we can properly discuss this.
But wasn't that the district court's point, that what ended up happening was there was an allegation that there was some substantiation and documents behind some of the alternative perpetrator evidence, and when both the state and trial counsel went to look, there was nothing that they could produce for the court to meet the standard to allow that line of questioning and that testimony in. And so as a result of that, there was no difference in the district court's view between the request at trial to admit the alternative perpetrator evidence and the argument made at the post-conviction proceeding. And that's why the post-conviction court denied the request for a hearing.
While I think that is what the post-conviction court found, I don't believe that I believe that what happened was that trial counsel was ineffective in pursuing this, and that an adequate record wasn't made about whether or not those documents existed. I think that
how was the trial counsel ineffective in pursuing it?
That he believed he had documents that he continued to represent he believed existed, but he just couldn't find.
But does that indicate that, I mean, the state was also, the court discussed with the state its effort, because I believe that if I remember the record correctly, the documents that we're referring to were police reports regarding the Peeping Tom, and neither the state nor the defense counsel, the trial counsel, could locate those documents.
Well, I believe the state had a different adversarial interest than the defense counsel, and I believe that the defense counsel was ineffective in pursuing what it had.
Well, the state had an obligation to produce that evidence if it was, you know, consistent with its Brady obligations. It was required to produce that.
Certainly, and I don't think we're stating that this is a Brady violation. We're stating that in the midst of a trial, those documents were not able to be produced by either party, and that it is the sort of situation where it could be easily resolved through an evidentiary hearing whether or not those documents existed at the time.
So what testimony from trial counsel would you expect would bear that out if your client had gotten an evidentiary hearing, other than what was previously on the record that he couldn't find the documents after going to look?
I think going through a direct examination matter of what documents do you see, what documents were there, and have you been able to locate those, or did you see them at a later date? Again, I think that can only effectively be done in an evidentiary setting.
I have a more basic question. Isn't this really trial strategy that is virtually unreviewable on appeal?
I don't believe that alternate perpetrator is purely trial strategy. I think there is some case law showing that it is more reviewable than, you know, a decision to call a witness or something else.
What case law would that be?
I could have a moment.
And I would just note that the post-conviction court also didn't note that appellant is trying to challenge trial strategy and discuss that issue as well.
I believe it's in the State v. Richards line of cases that it's a complete defense issue, and the raising a primary defense to the crime is more reviewable than pursuing a defense but doing it in a strategic way. It's clear that it was consistent with the strategy of defense counsel to pursue alternative perpetrator evidence, and his failure to do so is ineffective if such evidence did exist.
What about the decision to investigate and follow leads to support that alternative perpetrator strategy? I mean, that's a little more nuanced, and that falls within the wheelhouse of trial counsel's strategy decisions, wouldn't you agree?
Certainly, if it were, it's purely investigation, but I think this is basic review of the file, and I think that basic review of the evidence provided by the state doesn't fall into trial strategy.
Well, is the record that counsel, after making the representation that he saw something in the discovery indicating that there was a peeping Tom or something else to support an alternative perpetrator, that he simply did not go back and look at all? Or is the record that he looked and didn't find anything to further support that?
I don't believe the record is clear on that, and that's why I believe an evidentiary hearing is called for.
The way I read the post-conviction order that the district court issued, it appeared to me that it was the latter, that the trial counsel could not produce that, and the state said likewise. So if that's the case, then really, is that objectively unreasonable? He went to look. It's not as though I could see the case that you're making if he didn't make any effort to follow up after representing that he thought he saw something, but this is a situation where it looks to me from the record that he came back to the court and didn't have the offer of proof, and that's why the theory wasn't allowed to proceed.
I think that the record shows that he was overtaxed in the middle of a murder trial and represents to the court that he'd been up all night and he didn't really have time to get this done. And I believe that the record shows he was not adequately prepared to raise that defense.
What regarding your argument about the spark of life evidence?
Yes.
You would agree that we review admissibility of unobjected to evidence for plain error. That's something your counterpart indicated in.
Yes, Your Honor. I would.
State's brief. All right. And so is it your position that the admission of the spark of life evidence would meet the four prongs of the plain error test?
Your Honor, I certainly have raised that. I believe that it is likely the court would not agree with such a position.
And did you have any legal authority for your argument that the denial of the motions for mistrial and new trial, those were erroneous decisions by the district court?
Your Honor, I'll rest on what I argued in the motion. I believe that primarily we're here requesting this evidentiary hearing, Your Honor. I would cede the rest of my time.
Great. Thank you, Counsel.
Thanks.
Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name and the party you are representing. You may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota in this matter. As appellant's counsel has articulated, his main argument here is that his ineffective assistance of counsel claim should be remanded for a post-conviction evidentiary hearing.
Before we get there, since we were just on the standard of review question, I was reviewing the Supreme Court's decision from State v. Santoya from 2010, and it has this weird I guess I've been trying to resolve the standard as it was articulated in that case, because that was a spark of life case that wasn't objected to. They said it's plain error, but then ultimately they concluded it wasn't an abuse of discretion to let the evidence in. For spark of life evidence, is it a true plain error test, or is there some indication in the case law that we still need to review it for abuse of discretion?
I believe when the case law is clear, in my mind, when it's an evidentiary ruling that appellant is trying to challenge on appeal and it was not objected to at trial, that falls under the four-prong plain error test.
And there's no special exception for spark of life. That's all I wanted to...
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
It's the abuse of discretion as to admitting the evidence, like any evidence, right? It's an abuse of discretion standard. That would be, if there was an abuse of discretion, that would be the error in the first prong, right?
Sure.
So that's...
Yes.
But you still then would have to proceed after determining that we would have to proceed after determining there was an abuse of discretion to determine that that error was plain, affected the defendant's substantial rights, and seriously impacted the fairness and integrity of the proceedings?
Correct. Okay. Yes, I agree with that.
Why wasn't it objectively unreasonable for defense counsel to, as your counterpart has pointed out, apparently sought information underlying its offers of proof on alternative perpetrator mid-trial? I mean, this was a case, as counsel pointed out, 14-year-old at the time that it occurred, a significant sentence looming, notice of the alternative perpetrator defense is given. Nobody was blindsided by that, and yet mid-trial, counsel scrambling to try to find information to support the offer of proof. Why isn't that objectively unreasonable?
Because I believe that the record demonstrates that counsel was consistently trying to provide an offer of proof ever since he first provided notice of the defense, which I think was back in June of 2021. And he successfully argued for a motion for continuance of the trial at that time to investigate alternative perpetrators. In September of 2021, he filed the motion, notice listing specific individuals or groups of people.
But this is a little different than that, right? Because it's not as though defense counsel's investigator was out on the streets looking, trying to find witnesses. This was, trial counsel said, I thought I saw this in a document somewhere and I can't find it anymore. So at the time that the alternative perpetrator defense was filed, clearly trial counsel must have had that in mind, that there was this document that substantiated it. And then mid-trial, counsel's scrambling and saying, I thought I saw this somewhere, but I don't know where it is. Why isn't that objectively unreasonable?
Sure, and I don't know if I'm answering your question completely, but I do want to point to the record. Trial counsel did file an offer of proof with a police reports attached, as well as a defense investigator report attached, and that was on March 23rd. So to your point, it was during the trial, but it was before the state rested. It was before the defendant's case began. and in that, there is a report from the defense investigator who did speak with two of the neighbors, and one of which did say that she was told by another person just on the street in the neighborhood that other unknown person had seen people, had seen someone grabbing doorknobs, trying to open doors on the night of the murder. So just to the point of, I understand your point of that it was late and mid-trial, but I don't think that's necessarily unusual. But this does demonstrate that he had an investigator out there investigating. He was doing everything he could to put the pieces together and to provide an offer of proof that the district court was looking for, and that ultimately he just couldn't make that a sufficient showing
There was a police report, wasn't there, that both the state and the defense indicated they had seen regarding, and that was a document that wasn't produced by a defense investigator. Am I misremembering the record on that?
So I believe that the record discusses that, so the trial counsel is trying to argue that there's a report out there that would be sufficient for an offer of proof of the Peeping Tom, but he didn't have it. The district court, asked both parties to go and look for it, and that he wasn't going to, admit the evidence without that report. The state said, you know, there's very little known about this peeping Tom, but yes, we will go look for it. They came back, said, the prosecutor came back, said, we can't find it. If the defense can find it, please provide it to us. I think what defense did file is what is in the record is what that report was, and it's from the defense investigator. So I think the record is clear that there was some, both parties knew that there was something out there maybe, you know, tangentially about this. They couldn't find a police, neither party could find a police report on it. The defense found his investigator's report on it. to get back to why appellant is not entitled to an evidentiary hearing on this issue, you know, I think it's important to note that really his arguments just amount to argumentative assertions without factual support, and that he really, in the petition for post-conviction relief, appellant really failed to put any material facts into dispute. You know, I think he's looking back at the trial record and arguing kind of again what's already in the record. And so therefore, there aren't material facts in dispute. These are merely argumentative assertions. And so under the case law, that does not entitle a petitioner to an evidentiary hearing.
But we're talking about just requesting an evidentiary hearing in a post-conviction proceeding. That's a relatively low burden, particularly when you're talking about whether or not a person who is facing a very significant amount of jail time and an alternative perpetrator. So that really kind of goes to the heart of who actually did commit this crime, because we only have circumstantial evidence here. And granted, it is some DNA evidence, but it's still circumstantial. We don't have, you know, isn't it incumbent on the post-conviction court to at least have a hearing to ferret out whether or not there really was, whether or not those alternative perpetrator leads, whether or not there really was substance to it?
I would say if the appellant had been able to bring forth any facts in his post-conviction petition to entitle him to warrant a hearing to decide those facts.
Isn't that kind of a conclusory, I mean, isn't that the whole purpose of an evidentiary hearing, to see whether or not there actually is anything there? Because we're talking about potentially seven different leads. And, I mean, let's take, for example, I mean, I know the appellant focuses a lot on the peeping Tom, but you also had the group of people that were outside at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know, sadly, the victim here apparently did not have the best relations with the, you know, the people in the neighborhood. Isn't it incumbent on the post-conviction court to at least have a hearing to see whether or not there was anything there that could have substantiated an alternative perpetrator?
And I think it's important, and that's part of why I believe we have the trial judge handle any post-conviction proceedings typically. And in this case, that's what happened. And I think the post-conviction court was the trial court. He had presided over, you know, all of these lengthy discussions, asking, he was, you know, as the district court judge, probing the trial counsel, asking the trial counsel, where's your offer of proof? Give me your offer of proof. What do you have? Reviewing what he was able to produce and saying this is not sufficient under Hawkins' standard, and it's not admissible. And so then in the petition for post-conviction relief, the post-conviction court just really isn't being presented with anything new that would change that determination. And so there I don't believe that an evidentiary hearing would be warranted.
But under our standard, don't we have to assume all of the allegations in the petition are true? Doesn't the district court need to assume all of the allegations in the petition are true, regardless of what happened in the underlying trial? I mean, mm-hmm. Isn't there sort of the other flip side of that in terms of because the district court was there for the trial?
Sure.
They perhaps are reading more into the petition than the standard would say is appropriate?
And I guess there maybe I would pivot to another point of a petitioner is not entitled to an evidentiary hearing where even if the allegations are proven, he still conclusively would not be entitled to relief. And here, the state's position is that even if a hearing could develop facts on the first prong of Strickland, of whether it was objectively unreasonable to not further investigate and make an offer of proof, that he necessarily will fail on the prejudice prong.
Because of the DNA evidence and the fingerprints?
Yes, because no one else's fingerprints were found on the windowsills at the point of entry except appellants. No one else's DNA was identified on the victim's body except appellant's DNA, which was under her fingernails.
But wasn't there a different DNA on the toenails?
There was a different DNA that could not be identified under the toenails, and that was presented at trial and heard by the jury.
I have sort of a broader question, which is when it comes to, you know, alternative perpetrator theory, if this evidence didn't come out, it does seem like that there's some weight to the argument that if you don't have an evidentiary hearing, how can you actually investigate some of these things? Mm-hmm. An alternative perpetrator is sort of the, you know, if there was actual evidence out there that someone else committed the crime, that would be pretty weighty in terms of the prejudice prong, even with, you know, the fingerprint evidence and the DNA evidence. And so given the deferential standard of review that, you know, if there's any doubt as to whether there should be an evidentiary hearing, courts should favor having that hearing. I struggle with it because of what it is that they want to investigate, which seems to be pretty critical to the defense strategy at the trial itself.
Sure, and there I would just respond by saying I don't believe in the post-conviction petition that they really explain what they would be further developing through an evidentiary hearing. A post-conviction evidentiary hearing does not, you know, restart discovery. The prosecution would not be disclosing our file to appellant. You know, that's not the purpose of a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. So it really would be, you know, maybe hearing from trial counsel of what was he thinking, what did he know at the time.
But it doesn't go beyond just what he knew or what he was thinking, but doesn't it go to potential documents that were, in fact, in the record that he just didn't have the time to get to or to find because he was in the middle of the trial at that point? And if those documents actually do exist, isn't there the potential that the defendant here could have been exonerated if there was, in fact, mm-hmm. an alternative perpetrator?
Yeah, and I'll just say that, you know, appellant's counsel, you know, when he takes over the appeal, I would hope and assume and that he should receive the defense attorney's file. So the appellant should have that information and should have been able to raise that in their post-conviction petition to put material facts in dispute that would warrant an evidentiary hearing. So I certainly agree with the court that the burden is low and the standard is low to have an evidentiary hearing in a post-conviction proceeding, and it should be. But that doesn't mean that it's that just by filing a petition you automatically get a hearing. The petitioner needs to be held to some burden to allege some amount of facts that go beyond argumentative assertions that put material facts into dispute to get to a hearing. Unless there are any final questions, we would just ask the court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court.
It would be helpful to me if you could lay out precisely what facts you articulated in your petition that you think are material facts that would have assisted the court to have an evidentiary hearing. Like, if you could lay them out, that would be helpful to me.
I think at the core is what are the alternative perpetrator documents that were in the possession of the state and the defense. I believe opposing counsel said she believed that those documents were the ones provided in the offer of proof. I don't think there's any indication in the trial record that that's what the parties believed. I believe
that's a question. That's not a factual allegation in the petition. I mean, so you're entering into the evidence you're hearing as a fishing expedition, hoping to find information. That's what it sounds like to me, that would support the allegation that counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, rather than saying, here's what counsel didn't do, and if counsel had done this, then the result of the proceeding would have been different. I mean, is that what you're saying?
I think what I'm saying is that trial counsel said they had documents. They didn't produce those documents, and I have not seen those documents, but I believe the only way I can know is through an evidentiary hearing, and I don't know another way to do that.
Wouldn't you be getting those documents from trial counsel?
I believe that there's a difference between trial counsel having those documents and trial counsel having had those documents.
Say that again.
I believe that if trial counsel originally had those documents, he could possibly not have those in his file at this point. I think there is a question as to whether or not those documents existed, and that's what I believe an evidentiary hearing would provide.
Couldn't you have called trial counsel and asked? Isn't there some minimal amount of investigation that could have been done prior to requesting an evidentiary hearing?
I believe through a contested hearing would be the appropriate way to do that, as opposed to given his trial counsel. I believe otherwise he would have produced those documents at trial.
But you would have access to the defense counsel's records. What the evidentiary hearing in a situation like this is more designed to do is to have the testimony as to what trial counsel was thinking, but we're really talking about the underlying documents and whether or not they were in the record. And so that's something that it seems like you'd be able to obtain.
I believe that an evidentiary hearing with his testimony is the way we could explore what he knew and when he knew it, essentially.
But that's the fishing part, right? Because, you would think the allegation would be this document existed, counsel didn't use it to substantiate and make the offer of proof for alternative perpetrator, therefore counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. But what I'm hearing you say is, this document might have existed, I don't know, I need to have this evidentiary hearing to figure out whether or not it existed or not. Is that right?
Yes.
Or alternatively, the trial record indicates that this document existed. I received my client's file. This record is not in my client's file. Therefore, we need an evidentiary hearing to figure out where this document went. I mean, that would also, right? I mean,
yeah.
I think the problem is that the way that this petition has been framed is we don't know whether this document existed or not, as opposed to a direct allegation that this document exists.
And I believe that is a framing where it is appropriate for this court to grant a hearing or to remand for a hearing. I have nothing further.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing on this issue. The issue is submitted to us, and we will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame.
Thank you.
Thank you both.